Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing, it's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire, the permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Our guest today is the great Will Grigg from Pro Libertate. That's the website, Pro Libertate at Freedom in Our Time. .blogspot.com. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Welcome back to the show. Will, how are you doing?
Scott, it's always a pleasure to be with you. Thank you so much.
Well, I'm very happy to have you on the show. Good to talk to you again. And now, I can't talk Russian very good. That'd be the wife's area of expertise. So go ahead and tell him, Dr. What's his name, I presume?
Ah, you're talking about Dr. Raskolnikov.
Who's Dr. Raskolnikov? Yeah, that guy.
Well, there's no doctor of that name to the best of my knowledge, but I hung that sobriquet around the neck of one of the supposedly expert witnesses in the murder trial of two of the eight officers who beat Kelly Thomas to death in Fullerton, California, about, it's about 2.5 years ago. It was 2011, July of that year. And there's a fellow by the name of Dr. Stephen Karch. As I understand it, he's a consulting cardiologist from Berkeley, who has made a very handsome career as an expert witness and as a tutor on the for the benefit of police regarding such subjects as excited delirium and other exotic diagnoses that describe afflictions that descend only upon people who are being beaten and kicked and otherwise abused by police.
Oh, and yeah. That's one of those. It wasn't the taser that killed him. It was the heart attack that he had while I was tasering him.
Exactly. There are these propitiously timed cardiac events or other sudden seizures that only occur...
He had a brain explosion when I shot him. What's the big deal?
There's this bizarre inverse observer effect that he talks about here, where there's simply a time appointed to somebody to die who has a certain condition, and that condition may elude the professional scrutiny of doctors who are not as adept as he, at least that's Stephen Karch's perspective. Mm-hmm. And so what he does is he abstracts from these episodes of lethal violence the actual involvement of the police officers at the time. In the case of Kelly Thomas, Karch, who had never examined the body and had not treated Kelly Thomas and didn't know Kelly Thomas before he was beaten to death, Dr. Karch suggested that because of an alleged prior history of severe drug abuse, that the victim's heart had been left distended and unhealthy, and that he just happened to expire from a heart attack while he was being crushed and beaten and tasered by a thug scrum of eight of Fullerton's supposed finest. And the official rendering, the official verdict, if you will, from the coroner was that he died as a result of oxygen deprivation to his brain and to his heart because his windpipe was crushed and because his chest was being compressed underneath a burden of the better part of a ton of tax-subsidized suet. And to anybody who's burdened at all by honesty and who has a grasp of the obvious, the conclusion should be clear that there is some colorable connection between the violence inflicted on Kelly Thomas by the police and his premature death, that Karch was trying to say that because of prior drug abuse decades ago, that Mr. Thomas had done irreparable damage to his own body, and furthermore, he had probably done irreparable damage to his own brain and to his own mind, that he supposedly had a psychotic episode in which he chose to fight these police, and he was supposedly bowling them down like 10 pins or throwing them around like rag dolls, none of which is supported by the half-hour-long video that was captured by a local surveillance camera or by any of the plentiful eyewitnesses on the scene. They all described how this 160-pound man, who apparently suffered from schizophrenia, who was living on the streets and who may have been a nuisance but was otherwise completely harmless, was complacent. He wasn't violent, but he did put up a fight once he was attacked by Officer Cincinelli, who was, along with Officer Ramos, the instigators of this act of gang violence. That once he was pinned down to the ground and being beaten and tasered, he put up a struggle because of the natural instinct one has to defend oneself against criminal violence. But I compared Dr. Karch to Rodion Raskolnikov from Crime and Punishment. Raskolnikov was somebody who flattered himself as being a world historic transcendent figure who was not bound by the moral law. And to establish this principle, he plotted to kill a really unpleasant older woman who was a pawnbroker, a very wealthy woman, not much loved by anybody, and who would not be missed. And he actually explained his intent to a police officer, Raskolnikov did, and justified it in the name of the greater good. After all, if she were allowed to die and make provisions for her own estate, her money would end up going to a monastery somewhere instead of being devoted to the greater good of the community. So because she's going to die anyway, and there's a certain percentage of people who are just fated to die or otherwise be discarded by society, why not we redeem this somehow by having her killed in a way that will allow her money to be used to benefit the lives of people who are otherwise blighted by misfortune, and so on and so forth. His conceit in this instance, Raskolnikov, was that he knew that there was a percentage of people who are going to be disposed of, and so we don't really have to treat them as if they're full human beings. And that seems to me to be very, very similar to what Karch is peddling for the benefit of police departments and law enforcement agencies. It is a ritual now. When you see somebody who dies after a taser strike or after a chokehold has been applied or other supposedly non-lethal means of subduing somebody have been employed, one of the first things you hear about is the phrase excited delirium. And excited delirium, once again, is something you only see in encounters involving police violence. You don't see excited delirium being used as a diagnosis or as a cause of death in cases where the police are absent and somebody suffers a fatal heart attack or a stroke or something of that sort. But practically any time somebody is tasered and goes into cardiac arrest, they blame excited delirium rather than the fact that this man has just been electrocuted and that there are dangers that are involved in sending a voltage and amperage of that magnitude through a human being. And Karch has been at the forefront of this. He's been at some of these taxpayer-subsidized gatherings sponsored by the Bureau of I'm trying to remember the name of the specific sub-bureau there at the Department of Justice. I think it's the Bureau of Justice Statistics or there's some subdirectory at the Bureau of the Department of Justice that actually subsidizes these gatherings in places like Las Vegas and other redoubts of contemplation, where police gather together and they spend taxpayer subsidies and stipends, a lot of it going into the types of vices that they would probably punish in their hometown communities, in order to be marinated in the latest doctrines of qualified immunity. And one of the people who have been presenters at these events has been Dr. Karch. In addition to being paid $700 an hour to dispense his puerile certitudes from the witness stand during the murder trial there in California. And just today, incidentally, Scott, I've been listening to the closing arguments by the DA, Tony Rakakis, there in Orange County. And much to my amazement, and my delighted amazement, among the things that he touched on was the fact that a police officer does not have the right to dispense summary punishment. In other words, he was talking about what we sometimes refer to as contempt of cop, how that's probably the most commonly enforced non-statutory law that results in police inflicting violence on people. It's not that they have probable cause or that they have reasonable suspicion to treat somebody as a criminal suspect. They just don't like the person's attitude, and so they invent some reason to go hands-on and inflict some street justice. That's another expression that describes the same thing as punishment for contempt of cop. And what Rakakis is saying is that if police officers are going to be responsible and professional, they will investigate crimes and arrest suspects, but they can't simply dispense summary punishment. And another thing he said that I found remarkable for a prosecutor, district attorney in particular, is that you have the right as a citizen to defend yourself against excessive force from a police officer. That's the first time I've heard this said, at least in recent memory, by a prosecutor or a district attorney, that Ramos, as somebody who was not conducting an arrest, but simply tormenting and mocking this mentally disabled man, instigated violence, which means he had no right to defend himself if Kelly Thomas decided to fight back. He actually said as much. He said the only way that the right to self-defense would apply to what Ramos and Cincinnati were doing is if they had backed off and tried to de-escalate the situation and bring an end to the hostilities, and if Thomas took the initiative to retaliate against them, in that case, he said, you might have a situation where self-defense would apply. But he cited from the relevant statutes in California state law dealing with self-defense and dealing with the use of force by police officers to underscore something I've been saying for at least 8 or 9 years now, which is that there is a natural right that inheres in the individual to defend yourself against aggressive violence from police. And that right includes the not privilege, but the necessity of defending yourself against unlawful arrest, up to and including the use of lethal force if necessary under the Bad Elk decision of 1900. So yeah, That's remarkable to hear that same
absolutely
kind of idea.
Yeah, I've never heard a prosecutor say something like that before. Maybe a retired one or something.
Exactly.
Hang on, it's Will Grigg from freedominourtime.blogspot.com. We'll be right back.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
All right, so welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is the Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Will Grigg from freedominourtime.blogspot.com. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. And we're talking about the lawlessness of law enforcement, and in this case, the beating death of Kelly Thomas and the actual trial of the cops. And right before the break there, Will, you were talking about the prosecutor's closing statement. First of all, it's amazing that this thing came to trial at all. Then you say the prosecutor's gone so far to explain that cops are not supermen. They're just the enforcers of the law, and that all human beings have the right to self-defense, even from a cop if he's using unjust force. And so, you know, that really is echoing what you're saying there. That's huge that a prosecutor would admit that fact, and that's going to come back to bite the state of California in the ass in the future,
too. It certainly is, and assuming that we end up with a guilty verdict here. I mean, if the jury rules on the facts, there'll be a guilty verdict, but that doesn't always happen, obviously.
Right.
But if we end up with a guilty verdict in which the jury has been persuaded of the guilt of the officers by inter alia the invocation of the right of the citizen to defend himself against unlawful force by police officers, we're looking at something that may be a Copernican revolution in our legal system, because since no later than the mid-1960s, it has just been assumed. This is something that was done through administrative action, through bar associations, and by prosecutors working in their jurisdictions, and by courts, not by legislation. It's been assumed that what is called violent self-help on the part of a citizen being subjected to an unlawful arrest or other abuse by a police officer was impermissible, not because it was illegal. Because, as I mentioned just before the break, the still prevailing precedent is a case from 1900 called Bad Elk versus the U.S., in which the Supreme Court of the United States said that a police officer trying to arrest somebody unlawfully is simply an abductor and can be dealt with as such. And you can have, as recently as within the last 10 or 12 years, any number of precedents in local or state courts recognizing the right to resist unlawful arrest. But as a matter of policy, it's been assumed that you simply have no choice but to submit. I call this the rapist doctrine, which is to say, just let it happen, because if you resist, things will go worse for you.
And yeah, I mean, this is where we get to never mind words on paper. If you resist them, they'll kill you. So
yeah.
Isn't it worth it to just go to, if you can get away with, you know, maybe just a beating and a few nights in jail and eventually a chance to talk to a judge, you know, presuming you don't get hauled off to Guantanamo or something,
sure.
Maybe it would be better to not, I mean, because, man, they got radios, too. There's never more of you than there are of them.
Yeah, that's a principle that Edmund Burke was talking about way back in the 1760s, about how if he's dealing with somebody who's a common thug, then Burke would be able, assuming that he had the astuteness and the physical capacity to do so, he would be able to vindicate his own rights in dealing with such a person, unless that person acted on behalf of the state, in which case that individual and all of his associates would combine to bring about his ruin. And that's what happened with Kelly Thomas. You had two people start beating this terrified 160-pound guy, and within a trice, there was a diabolical host, if you will, pounding on him to the point where they literally beat him into an irreversible coma, beat him to death, in effect, right there in the street.
And
not
Will,
because
look,
he had
I
done
mean,
anything wrong.
Isn't it right that he was just another bum that they murdered because they felt like it, but the problem was that his father was a cop?
Yes, that's another aspect of this that I wanted to underscore, is the fact that his father's a retired deputy sheriff. And that has a lot to do, I suspect, with the way that this has worked out. There was some political juice on the part of the family here, and that might explain why this case, unlike a number of others, actually found traction. There have been
yeah, he's an honorary human in a way. They
exactly.
found out after the fact that, oops,
yeah.
this guy had he was a made guy or the son of a made guy, and so
yeah,
you're not supposed to touch him.
It's the inverse of the corruption of blood principle. It's because his father had been part of the Brotherhood of Coercion that people were willing to listen to him, unlike the relatives of dozens or scores or hundreds of other people who have been treated exactly the same way, albeit not quite with such lurid sadism necessarily in California and elsewhere. And there's another case that illustrates this again. This is another almost unprecedented development, and that's what happened in Atlantic City with the case of Officer Sterling Wheaton. Back in 2008, Sterling Wheaton, who was part of a little group that just loved to set upon tourists there in Atlantic City, arrested for no reason and then unleashed his dog on an individual by the name of Michael Trosso, T-R-O-S-O. Mm-hmm. And it took 5 years, but eventually there was a civil trial, and the Atlantic City government, municipal government, and the police department were found liable. But Officer Wheaton himself was found personally liable. In other words, he was no longer given the benefit of so-called qualified immunity, and he's been ordered to pay $250,000 in restitution, half of the $500,000 settlement, to Mr. Trosso. And that's the first time, once again in recent memory, that a police officer has actually been held personally liable for an act of criminal violence. Now, here's the kicker. Michael Trosso was not just another black tourist in Atlantic City, but he was a deputy state attorney general in the state of New Jersey. In other words, it just happened that you have this individual who had some political clout, who was on the receiving end of what goes on every single day, no doubt, in Atlantic City and elsewhere. And so I applaud the precedents that are being set here, and I do have highly qualified optimism that these may have a tonic effect on what's going on across the country, but it still remains a question of your status in our supposedly small-r Republican society where the law is supposed to be king. And you mentioned the lawlessness of law enforcement, Scott. One of the things that people don't understand is the elemental paradox of what is called law enforcement. In order for them to enforce the law, they have to violate it, because the paramount law in all human action is the law of non-aggression. And anytime you're involved in aggression, you're breaking the law. And so the quotidian corruption of police officers who are parking in handicapped parking spaces or running stoplights or otherwise, you know, conspicuously violating these positivist enactments that we would be punished for violating, that's of a piece with what they do professionally. What they do professionally as a caste is they systematically violate the non-aggression principle. And I'm hoping, and this last year, as a matter of fact, has given me a little bit of cause for optimism on this front in terms of the philosophical revolution happening in this country. I'm hoping that this is going to be the year where a huge number of people in this country start examining police as from the perspective of what it is they're doing relative to the natural law, to the law of non-aggression. Mm-hmm. A couple of days ago, and I wrote about this on the Rockwell's blog, I believe it was on Sunday, I picked up a young couple who'd been stopped by the police here in Payette. They were in their early 20s. They were visibly, on very brief examination, I recognized as looking at young adults, but they were stopped by a cop, and when I picked them up, they had been walking on a very chilly morning. I drove them over to Ontario, Oregon, which is just a few miles away from here. I asked why the cop had detained them, and they explained to me, well, the cop said that we looked like juveniles, and he thought we might be runaways. I said, it seemed to me obvious that you're in your 20s. You know, he's a trained observer. I'm supposedly not a trained observer, but it was obvious to me that you were not juveniles. But even if you were juveniles, you're stopped for walking on a public street in broad daylight on a Saturday morning. Now, once again, there's no probable cause. There's no reasonable suspicion. He was conducting essentially a stop and frisk here in the city of Payette. One of the things the young man in this couple said to me when I mentioned what I did is that half the internet now is talking about police abuse. And he's exaggerating perhaps very, very little, because over the last several years, owing to the decentralization of information gathering and distribution, we've been having all these conversations everywhere except through official channels, and it is having a measurable impact on the way people perceive what is being done. Mm-hmm. People now are willing to admit that the police are a problem, and they're a frequent problem, and that the aggression of police is something that's become a real societal crisis. I'm hoping people make the philosophical connection here to the fact that what they do as a matter of job description is violate the non-aggression principle, and they need to ask themselves, by what right do people claim a license to commit aggression against other human beings? Why do we tolerate that state of affairs? Because as a country, we didn't always do that. This is a fairly recent development in the broad scope of the history of American society, and it's by no means set in stone that it has to continue this way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that, I don't know how much, you know, little d democratic power the people of the country really have to change it, but certainly the sentiment is changing. There's no doubt about that if you just read, mainstream newspaper editorials on the subject that, like, hey, maybe Balco's right, that this is going a little too far, y'all, and that's a really refreshing change, especially considering all of the endless TV propaganda about how essential these people are to our minute-to-minute security, you know?
Yeah, and they're still, I think, cruising on that social momentum. There's a program coming out on NBC in, I believe, a couple of weeks that basically glorifies this gang unit in Chicago that was nothing more than the apex gang in the city's underworld. The difference is it was organized and funded by the Chicago Police Department. Basically, they're valorizing and they're holding up as role models the people who were involved in the torture cases over the last 20 or 30 years. The Don Berg's case, if you're familiar with that cretin and his cronies.
They're in desperate straits. They don't know what else to do. They can't deny it anymore.
Yeah, so they're turning it into a made for a primetime TV drama on the assumption that there's an audience out there. And I don't know, outside the Fraternal Order of Police, I don't know what demographic they're targeting here, because I don't think that people, even those who become inured to police misconduct by watching propaganda shows like Cops and the like, are going to make a hero out of this guy. Then again, I was wrong about Vic Mackey. I thought that The Shield was going to be something that most people would recoil from because of the fact that you're dealing with such an aggressively amoral and despicable human being. And unfortunately, he became somewhat of an anti-hero. You know, back before Walter White, there was Vic Mackey. Mm-hmm. But I do think that the temper of our conversation as a country is changed now. And we've reached saturation point, many of us in any case, with what's happening and the fact that there is impunity on the part of most police officers who misbehave. So I hope this is the year that things change for the better.
Me too. Thanks, Will. I sure appreciate your time on the show, as always.
You bet. Thank you so much, Scott. You take care.
All right, but that is the heroic William Norman Grigg. Will Grigg. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. He is the essential chronicler of police abuse in America.
Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council of the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, y'all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at libertystickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at libertystickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at the bumper sticker. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.